Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Deb Ron Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the third week of April. This week, we are very happy to be recording out in the field again. Today, exploring the coast with our guide, Nam Su, looking for seaweed. Nam is a habitat biologist with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, and especially knowledgeable about our native seaweeds. Welcome, Nam. It's so nice to have you on our program.
Yeah, hi there. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. And we're also joined by our good friend and fellow seaweed enthusiast, Meg Amos, who will be our recorder today. Welcome, Meg.
Thank you, Deborah. I'm glad to be here.
Before we start our beach walk, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. As most of our listeners know by now, I often give our guests the option of choosing the mystery sound of the week. And this one was Nam's. We'll play it again at the end of the program, and he will tell us more about it. We often start our program by mentioning some of the cool things that we've been seeing out in the natural world this past week. Have you been seeing many signs of spring, Nam?
Yeah, I have. I'm an avid diver, and I've been doing a lot of diving, and I would say some of the coolest things I've seen this spring so far are lingcod nests underwater.
Wow!
So male lingcod guarding their nests.
Oh, how cool is that? Have the eggs been laid yet?
Yeah, so the eggs were laid mid to late winter by the females, and then the males stay behind and guard the eggs on these nests. And the eggs actually look like styrofoam stuffed in underwater crevices and cracks and caves. And so oftentimes you'll see an egg mass, and if you look carefully, you'll probably find a male nearby protecting it.
Wow, how cool. So how deep would that be?
You know, I see that anywhere from as shallow as 5 feet down to as deep as I can dive.
Wow.
And I'm free diving, so as deep as I can dive on a breath hold.
And Meg, have you been seeing anything interesting out your way in Quilcene?
Well, I guess my favorite would be the above ground scene, which is the fresh lime green sweetness of all of the trees. And bleeding hearts and...
Well, I've been loving that green too. And I heard my first orange-crowned warbler a couple of days ago. And I've had a male downy woodpecker drumming loudly near some potential nest cavities. You know, I've had them nesting on my place the last couple of years. And it's amazing how loud the drumming is. I mean, it's not making a cavity. It's making the sound to denote that this is his space. So it's been fun to hear that. And red elderberry shrubs are starting to bloom. And I stopped by the Kaitai Prairie, which is that little pocket prairie across from the KPTZ radio station. And the lumatium, the parsley is in bright yellow, but the common camas is starting to come up, and it's that beautiful sky blue. And keep your eyes out, all you listeners, or go on a little visit, because it'll be a sea of blue in 2 or 3 weeks' time.
Have to check that out.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. On to our program. We're getting distracted with all the other things, but we're here on the beach, and we've long wanted to learn more about our local seaweeds. So we were very excited when someone as knowledgeable as Nam agreed to take us on a field trip. We should probably start the show by setting the stage for where we'll be exploring. Do you want to describe the site for us, Nam?
Sure. We are sitting here at lovely Point Hudson in Port Townsend. This is a very special place for many reasons, most of which the reason why we're here is because this is a hotbed of algal diversity. There is actually a little back sand spit here and a back lagoon that tends to catch a lot of the drift algae that are ripped up by the storms. So it's a place that I frequently visit to collect specimens and look at what's been washed up by the winter storms. But it's also a very special place culturally. You know, this was a gathering place for the local native people before settlement. It was a very popular gathering place for the Sklom people. I don't think there was a settlement here, but this was a common gathering place where they would have potlucks and whatnot. And of course, Chesimoka Park is just down a ways. It's also a very important place locally for you know, more modern times. Of course, this was a developed port of entry during just after World War I, and was an immigration stop during World War II and beyond. So a very unique place indeed. But going back to the uniqueness of this ecosystem, this is at the confluence of the Puget Sound and Admiralty Inlet. This is where two very complex and different water bodies come together, and it's one of the reasons why it's a hotspot for algal diversity.
Uh-huh. Great. Well, we chose our date for this recording with the tides in mind also. We've got some especially nice low tides in the middle of the day this month, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think right about now is a zero tide, which is pretty low. And it is, it's a real good daytime low tide series for us to be out here. And I was actually out here with the Jefferson County Beach Naturalist class yesterday, and it was raining sideways. So I'm very thankful to be out here with you two on a sunny day.
I know. I checked ahead with the weather, and we had already set the day, so there was nothing we could do about it. But I was so thankful also that it was like yesterday. And there are a lot of people out on the beach, so we'll hear a little bit of crunching and as people go past with their bicycles and their dogs and whatever. We chose our dates for this recording in accordance with the best time of the year to see a variety of different types of seaweed. Also, we asked you, and you told us that March and April are usually the best months to look for seaweed. Is it the best time to see it wash up on the beach, or the best time to harvest it for eating, or both?
It's the best time for a number of reasons. Like we previously mentioned, you know, right now is the time of the year where we have good daytime low tides. A lot of times later in the year, you know, these low tides correspond with nighttime. The nighttime in the winter, for instance, and in the fall. So, you know, not only is it great that we have these daytime low tides, but it's also the beginning of the growing season for a lot of this algae and seaweed. And so this is the time that I like to collect algae, because this is when they are relatively small still. There's a lot of new growth, and they have yet to be fouled or have epiphytes. So other algae or other organisms grown on them, typically in the late summer, they start deteriorating, and so it's not as nice to collect either for harvest for eating reasons or for specimen preservation reasons. Not only that, yeah, this is the tail end of the winter storm season, so it's this time of the year during these low tides that I tend to find a lot of new growth that's been ripped up and deposited on at Point Hudson here.
Uh-huh. Great. And before we start to talk about specific types of seaweed, we should probably ask you to define what we mean by seaweed. It isn't as simple a question as it once was with all the recent changes in taxonomical classification. I mean, all the guides go, you know, this is still in dispute. So seaweeds are considered marine algae for sure. But what's the recent thought on how algae are classified?
Yeah, so there's a lot out there, and as you mentioned, it is, you know, disputed among scientists, but, you know, I think for the most part, when you get really deep into the science, there are a lot of lumpers and splitters that want to always reclassify things, and for what it's worth, I'm always relearning new names, new genus names of these, but for the layman, for the common person, you know, these seaweeds, they're submerged aquatic vegetation, you know, they're a part of the kingdom Plantae. They are underwater plants. And that said, I will specify that there are true, what we define as true vascularized plants in this ecosystem. And I'm looking at some right now in forms of seagrass, both surf grass and eelgrass, which we will talk about later. But of course, when it comes to seaweed, we specifically referring to macroalgae as opposed to microalgae, which we think of as phytoplankton. Seaweeds are macroalgae. These are submerged aquatic vegetation that is typically quote-unquote rooted or bound to the sediment where they're growing. And if you ask me, they are the grandparents of all the terrestrial land plants that we have on the planet.
Uh-huh. That's a good way to think about it. And so when we talk about seaweeds, we're talking about macroalgae. And then these are in turn divided into three broad categories, depending on their pigmentation, right?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. This is a really easy way for us to, you know, look at the different groups of seaweed. They're typically broken up by the coloration or the pigment, the photoactive pigments that the majority of them have. I'll break that down into the three main groups of the browns, the phaeophytes, the reds, the rhodophytes, and the green algae, the chorophytes. That said, it's not often as easy as just looking at their coloration, because there are some curveballs out there that look brown but are actually red, and there are some that are red that are actually brown.
Of course. it's never simple in the natural world, but it's nice to have those general categories that we can go to. How many different species would you expect to find on a normal walk along the beach in our area?
So in our area, again, keeping in mind that, you know, not only Point Hudson, but Port Townsend in general, you know, we are right at the confluence of both the Strait of Juan de Fuca just to the north and the Puget Sound just to the south and east of here. You know, we have the diversity from both these water bodies. We are, again, at the confluence of these two water bodies. So Port Townsend tends to be an area that has a higher amount of diversity, algal diversity, higher species richness, and higher numbers of species here. I would say today we're probably going to see at the minimum 2 to 3 dozen species out here. And for what it's worth, because of this high algal diversity, there is a lot of coral science history here. You know, one thing I want to share, and I always share in my science presentations about seaweed in the area, is that for those listeners that are familiar with Cannery Row or, John Steinbeck's work, Ed Ricketts actually used to spend his childhood here. And there is a famous picture here back a couple of years that was put in the Port Townsend Leader of him as a young adult over at Kinsey Beach off of Fort Worden, Point Wilson there, studying the algae.
Oh, sweet.
I like to think that, you know, this algal diversity was what inspired him to go on to be the famous naturalist he became,
That the boat, the Western Flyer, that Steinbeck and Ricketts were on is being restored.
Yes.
Here, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's a lot of cool connection to science history in our town.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a big question, and we're going to have to be careful to not spend the rest of our show with it. But would you please review the general life histories and cycles of the various types of seaweeds for us? I know it can often be quite complicated. Many are seasonal, at times microscopic, at other times large and clearly visible. And then they can also reproduce both sexually and asexually, right?
Yeah, that's correct. You know, that's one thing that makes, you know, seaweeds so fascinating. You know, I mentioned earlier that sometimes the color that they look like is not necessarily the color or of the order they belong to. And similarly, there's a huge diversity in reproductive strategies and life histories in amongst all of the seaweed that we have here. And it's one of the reasons why it's so fascinating. So I'm not going to try to even tackle this because there are so many, but I will just say that their reproduction is really fascinating. It's only until pretty recently that we as researchers and scientists got a good handle of how to cultivate them in a lab setting. And I'm going to talk about Nereocystis or bow kelp as an example. There's a lot of work in the state right now looking at restoration of bow kelp. And as a matter of fact, Puget Sound Restoration Fund in the association with NOAA at their Manchester laboratory, they have a restoration hatchery there where they are growing juvenile bow kelp in order to outplant and restore some bow kelp beds in the sound to historic locations.
Oh, cool.
And what's I guess the one thing that the common person or the viewers or listeners should know is that these seaweeds and kelp, they have a microscopic life stage. So what you're seeing, that big charismatic, and to me kelp is charismatic, this big kelp, that is just one part of their life history. And another really essential part of it is in a microscopic stage where their zoospores are crawling around on rocks trying to find each other to produce a gamete that produce this big sporophyte. It's really complicated, but for instance, in bow kelp, that's an annual species. That big bow whip, organism, that giant organism grows in a matter of 1 year.
Wow, and that's outrageous. And how big, how many feet long? I mean, it's outrageous.
They as far as in depth, I've seen them in waters as deep as about 40 feet. So when you think about it, from the holdfast or their root structure to their stipe, which is their trunk structure, all the way to that bulb, that's like at least 40 feet. But sometimes they're even longer because they don't just come up vertically, but they drift, laterally.
Yep.
And then that's not even accounting for the different blades, the tens of feet of blade they have. And typically in the late summer, when you have these mature specimens, on the note of reproduction, especially with bow kelp, you will see the spore patches on those blades. So for any listeners that have seen a washed up piece of bow kelp and you look at some of the older blades, which are their leaves, you will see patches, darker color patches in the middle. Those are actually spore organelle that is putting, they're the spore patches that they use to reproduce.
Wow.
Yeah, but really amazing organism and some of the fastest growing organism on Earth.
Well, and I heard, but I think this figure was for giant kelp that was like 20 inches per day. It was something outrageous, but bull kelp was close to that, right?
Very similar. Uh-huh. Yeah, I have in my mind like a meter a day, but somewhere in that range, like multiple feet per day.
That's outrageous. So as some of the species that we'll see washed up on the beach are not considered to be seaweeds, but instead sea grass, right? And they're more closely related to the lily family than to the algae?
Yeah, so as I alluded to earlier, we are going to be looking at some true plants. In the scientific, world, the, definition of a true plant is one that actually has vascularization. So they have specialized cells that, transport gases and fluids and nutrients inside them. Whereas for the most part, seaweed and kelp, although they have specialized structures such as holdfasts and blades and even pneumatocysts, like that air bladder that helps hold them up, if you look at a cellular level, all the cells are pretty similar and there's no specialized vascularization up and down the plant like a phloem or xylem in trees and uh-huh. other true plants. However, seagrasses are a true plant. They have vascularization. Their root structures are highly specialized. They uptake nutrients at those root structures. Whereas, for comparison, seaweeds and kelp, they're taking up nutrients all over their entire, body. Whereas, again, in these true plants like seagrasses, they have very specialized structures like roots where they take up nutrients that blades that's used for photosynthesis and whatnot. And the interesting thing about these true plants that are in the marine environment, they have a very similar evolutionary history as our marine mammals. They are actually evolved or derived from land plants that went back to the sea.
Oh, that's
so yeah, seagrasses are actually related to land grasses that came out onto land, evolved on land, and then went back into the ocean, just like marine mammals.
Uh-huh. And just to clarify, when we see like the macroalgae or the seaweeds, we see what looks like a root, but that's just to hold them in place. It's really a hold fast. They don't use it to take up nutrients. Their whole body takes up nutrients and they photosynthesize. Their whole body photosynthesizes, right?
Yes, that's correct. And so although there are analogous structures like the roots of a true plant, the holdfast structure, doesn't have that specialized nutrient uptake like you're mentioning.
Yep. Back to the grasses. We're seeing now exposed eelgrass and also surf grass. And they're really important, right? Especially eelgrass. Would you like to tell us a little bit about that, please?
Sure, absolutely. So you are correct. We are looking out right now at the tide flat here at Point Hudson, and we're seeing both eelgrass and surf grass. It's another reason why I really like this location, because this is one of the few locations in the Puget Sound where you have an overlap of both surf grass and eelgrass. Typically, they don't overlap because they have very different habitats. Surf grass, tend to prefer high energy environments and rocky bottoms. That's why they're called surf grass. They live in the surf zone. Whereas in eelgrass, they prefer soft sandy sediment. But here at Point Hudson, we have a mixture of both. It is very eelgrass, all seagrasses. And if you ask me, similarly, all submerged aquatic vegetation, seagrass, kelp, seaweeds, they all ecologically have a very similar function. And they're all very important because they are nursery habitats for a number of very important commercial species and non-commercial species. They produce a near-shore migratory corridor for endangered salmon. So when you think about all of the endangered salmon south of here, like in Chimicum Creek, like the Hood Canal Summer Chum, and all the salmon, as they hatch and come out of the rivers and out-migrate to the ocean, they are migrating in the near shore. And they are using these submerged aquatic vegetation beds, the eelgrass beds and kelp forests, they're using that as a refuge. They're using it as a corridor to out-migrate to the ocean where they can be protected and forage for their own food.
Oh, that's great. We'll have to continue this conversation next month. But before we let you go, let's hear the mystery sound of the week again. And it's the sound of a diver going underwater. And it's one of Nam's favorite sounds because he loves to dive. And the sound actually came from one of your own dive videos, right? Tell us a little bit about the world below the sea surface, please.
Yeah, you know, so I obviously am in kind of connected to these vegetations in multiple ways. And, you know, aside from my profession as a biologist for the state protecting these environments, I myself am a stakeholder in this. I spend most of my free time in the water. Like I said, I'm an avid diver, and I spend most of my time in these beautiful habitats just looking at fish underwater. I also do a fair amount of harvesting of different species. And so when I hear this sound, it just tells my brain that it's time to relax. You know, this is the sound that I hear when my head first goes underwater. And like I said, I'm a free diver. I do breath hold diving. And so that's, you know, when I hear the sound, it's when all the troubles of the world above the surface melts away, and I get to immerse myself in these beautiful environments like the kelp forests and seagrass beds.
Well, and I've heard that our area is a fabulous place to dive if you can just stand the cold, right? I mean, it's really diverse, and the water is clear, and you can see a lot, right?
It's absolutely beautiful. I think I've been told, maybe he was biased, the local dive shop owner Don, he told me that back in the day, you know, Jacques Cousteau used to say that the Pacific Northwest was his second favorite place to dive because of just how diverse and how, you know, just these beautiful kelp forests that we have. And so, yeah, if you can withstand the cold, but I would say a lot of times I'm so excited to get in and look at what's down there, I forget about the cold, and I stay a lot longer than I should because I come up freezing.
Yeah. So if you're free diving, how long can you hold your breath?
Underwater, my breath holds tend to limit to only about a minute or so, but that involves a lot of work, actually, you know, kicking down, staying down, looking around, and then coming back up. Typically, I limit my dives to about a minute for safety reasons and whatnot, and I try to limit myself to no deeper than 40 feet, but you know, certainly when training you can go a lot further and longer.
Yeah, well, when we go out and look at the seaweed, we see these tattered remains, but I would long to see the forest, you know, waving, which is what you see when you're down there, right?
Yeah, I would love to share with you some of my videos on YouTube. I will give you a link to my channel where you can come underwater with me and get my point of view from the camera that I bring down. So actually what we're seeing now, you see that plane waving its wings at us? That's one of our surveyors. That's my friend Rory Clark. He is one person on our shellfish team. And they're actually up there surveying at the low tide for harvesters. That's one way that the Department of Fish and Wildlife gets an estimate of the harvest pressure or the harvest effort of our shellfish beds. So we just had a flyby from one of our surveyors.
That's awesome.
Oh,
yeah.
That's cool. So did they check for harvesting of shellfish and of seaweed? Is there much pressure on the seaweed for harvesting?
Yeah, they're definitely isolated spots of high pressure. You know, the harvest regulations, which I think we will go in again later, you know, a person with a license can collect up to 10 pounds a day. So that's quite a bit. but it's a very niche thing and only specific groups of people do it. But yeah, there are areas where it's protected. There's only 3 state parks where it's actually allowed. That includes Fort Flagler, Fort Casey, and I don't think Fort Worden. That's one way, again, we as the state get an idea of harvest effort out there. Right now, he's doing it for intertidal clams, clam uh-huh. diggers, but we do it for crab pots. They go up and count buoys with crab pots, shrimp pots, and even fishing boats during salmon season.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for joining us, Nam and Meg.
Thank you for having me.
It was a pleasure, Deborah.
Oh, we were happy to have you. And we'll greatly look forward to hearing more about seaweed next month. Closing music this week will be Under the Sea from the film Little Mermaid. This is the remix version from Mr. Beats.
The human world, it's a mess. Life under the sea is better than anything they got up there. The seaweed is always greener in somebody else's lake. You dream about going up there, but that is a big mistake. Just look at the world around you, right here on the ocean floor. Such wonderful things around you. What more are you looking for? Under the sea, under the sea. Darling, it's better down where it's wetter. Take it from me. Up on the shore, they work all day. Out in the sun, they slave away. While the deep boating full time, you floating under the sea. Down here, all the fish is happy as off through the waves they roll. The fish on the land ain't happy. It's hard 'cause they in the bowl. But fish in the bowl is lucky. They in for a worse fate. One day when the boss get hungry.
Guess who called me on the plate?
What no, under the sea. Under the sea. Nobody beat us, fry us, and eat us in fricassee. We want the land folks loves to cook. Under the sea, we have to hook up. We got no trouble. Life is the bubbles under the sea.
Under the sea.
Under the sea.
Under the sea.
Since life is sweet here, we got the big here naturally.
Naturally,
even the sturgeon and the ray, they get the earth to start to play. We got the spirit, you got to hear it under the sea. Play the flute, the cop, play the hop, the place, play the bass, the sound, the job, the bass, play the brass, the chop, play the tom. The flute is the duke of soul. The ray, he can play the lings on the strings, the tom. Backing up the blackfish, he sings the svelte and the sprat. They know where it's at, they know that blowfish blow.
Dungeness River Nature Center is proud to support KPTZ programming like Nature Now. In memory of Dee and Beverly Swearingen, who taught their children and grandchildren the love and stewardship of nature. Dungeness River Nature Center, teaching generations about nature on the Olympic Peninsula at Railroad Bridge Park in Squim. More at DungenessRiverCenter.org.